Your season-long fantasy football league may be over, but there's still plenty of action every week at DraftKings.com, America's favorite one-week fantasy sports site where you could win huge cash every time you play. Dave from Boston won $1 million in one day just playing fantasy football at DraftKings. So did Matt from Florida and Ray from New Jersey. In fact, DraftKings has crowned a new millionaire nearly every week this season. And don't forget about their exciting money-making contests in other sports too, like hockey and college and pro hoops. DraftKings.com. Go there right now. Enter promotional code CHAIL. This is for my listeners only. If you do that, you can play for free in the $100,000 fantasy football contest this weekend. DraftKings.com, bigger events, bigger winnings, bigger millionaires. Enter CHAIL for free entry. Do it right now. DraftKings.com. That's DraftKings.com.
He's defeated every champion from every organization the sport of mixed martial arts has ever seen and retired from the octagon as the biggest draw and the industry's highest paid athlete of all time. And now Chael Sonnen's on podcast1.com. And for that, you're welcome.
Welcome to Chaelcast 1. You've all made another great decision by tuning in. Today's going to be a fun day. Listen, I'm going to have Don Fry. I'm going to have John Trosky a little bit later in the call. I talked to Don Fry earlier this morning, and the call ended when I hung up on him. Before I hung up on him, I said, Don, I'm done talking to you. Just call me in when it's your time. And the reason is there's two Don Fries. One is good and one is great. And when I talk about that, I'm talking about from an aspect of entertainment. Here's something about Don Fry, and it's the reason I respect him. He will take a stand, and he will not apologize for his position. Whether he's completely right or he's dead-ass wrong, he is who he is. He will answer your question if you ask him one. He does not worry about hurting feelings. He doesn't worry about political correctness. He is who he is, and he's a cowboy. And he looks at the world a little bit differently. But he's a lot of fun. He's entertaining. I can tell you he is in full spirits today. He is supposed to be calling into this show at 11:15 in the morning. He started calling his first time at 8 a.m. I said, hi, Don. He said, well, hello there, partner. And I said, let me guess, you're calling for the podcast. He said, that's right, right on time. That's what the Predator does. I said, well, not exactly, Don. You're 2 hours and 15 minutes early. Oh, goddamn, I've been out feeding the horses. I lost track of time. I didn't want to be late for you, partner. I said, no problem. Call back at 11:15. At 9 a.m., my phone rings and it's Don. Hey, how's that, partner? We ready to record? I said, yes, we are. And in 2 hours and 15 minutes, we will. He called one more time, which I didn't pick up. He then called my producer, Ben, who told me, oh, yeah, Don Fry's already called here today looking for you. I said, what a surprise. I don't even know how we got that number. So I appreciate his enthusiasm. I appreciate him not wanting to be late. When we come back from this commercial break,
we'll be joined with the Predator himself, the one and only,
Don Fry. For that, you're welcome. All right, guys. I keep talking about Onnit. O-N-N-I-T. You keep seeing Onnit advertised everywhere. MMA fighters are wearing it. Professional athletes are wearing it. You're starting to see celebrities drinking it on some of these terrible reality shows that my wife makes me watch. But Onnit actually works. Onnit.com/Chael and you can save 10%. That's for my listeners only. Onnit.com/Chael, save 10%. Guys, I have tried everything. On the outside chance that something would work. From the protein powders to the creatines to the multivitamins, the whole bit, and nothing ever does. And I was annoyed with the people that told me that it did. I will not be one of those guys. This is the number one podcast out there. I have my choice of advertisers. Nobody gets a spot on this show unless they have a proven product. I take Alpha Brain. I order Alpha Brain from onnit.com. I take it every morning. It helps me focus. It helps with mental drive. It increases my memory. These are my own experiences. I've passed this on to other people. I pass it on because I know it will help. This is a cheap product, guys. I'm not trying to sell you anything. As a matter of fact, you can even go to onnit.com/, put my name in there, Chael, and you'll save another 10%. I'm not selling you anything. I'm sharing with you my experience. But the people that have listened to me and the people that have taken it have all come back to thank me. It makes me look smart. It makes me look like a nice guy by telling you about this. Go to onnit.com today. Get yourself an Alpha Brain. You can thank me next time.
This is Your Welcome with Chael Sonnen.
We're back to Your Welcome. Don Fry, what's happening, man?
Not a doggone thing, partner. Not a thing. How about you?
Now, I got to tell you, Don, I thought that you were going to be a little bit flaky. I thought old Don's got so many chores to do. So many kids running around on the holiday season. He's going to be busy. I'm going to have to stay on him. You have called me 3 times today getting ready to record. You were the opposite of flaky.
Flaky's your forte there, Mr. Sonnen. I got things to do, so I want to, I try and stay in line and order. I try not to disappoint. I've never disappointed a woman in my life, so I'm trying not to disappoint the men listening out there.
Well, so far we're off to a good start. Now, are you in Arizona still?
No, I'm in California, partner.
Okay, where is home? I know you've got the ranch in Arizona, but are you just living in California to do work, or did you move the whole family out there?
No, the family's back in Tucson. I'm in California.
And how's California treating you? Are you finding work? I see you in. I've seen you in a lot of commercials. Actually, are you doing anything else right now?
We did a. What was it? A pilot for a show called Street Level. And by David, crimey, I'm pulling a brain fart, man. David's been a friend of mine for a couple of years, and now I can't even think of his last name.
And if he's your boss, too, maybe we should get his name down.
Yeah, I might want to think about that. Maybe write on my hand or something, huh?
Yeah, so, Ella, I'll tell you what, man. You're a cowboy. You're a real-life cowboy. Every time I see you wearing a pair of Wrangler's boots and a belt buckle, I don't see you blending into L.A. Am I wrong?
You know, not very well. Not very well, no. No.
Now, have you changed your way, though? Are you wearing, like, some Prada Gucci shoots and a little scarf?
No, I'm like Al Sharpton at a Klan rally,
That's kind of how I picture you. Yeah, man, you're going to stand out a little bit.
Which is
what I like about you.
Oh, come on, Chael. You don't like anything about me. Come on. Don't start kissing up this because I'm on your podcast.
No, man, there is some things I like. In fact, I even like to go around and mimic your voice every now and then.
Well, that'll get you laid, that's for sure.
I'll call some of my friends up that are Don Fry fans, and I'll say, yeah, this is the Predator. And they'll fall. I'll bring them in at least for a couple of moments before I disappoint them and let them know it's not really you. All right, so if there's anything I love, it's a Don Fry story. I'm going to tell a Don Fry story, and I want you to tell me what part of this is wrong. What part am I remembering wrong? But let's go back to the IFL. You were the coach of the Arizona team. I can't think for the life of me what your mascot was.
I can't either, boy. I'll tell you, it was a nightmare.
Right around 2007, we're out at Connecticut. The fight's going to take place at the Mohegan Sun. The night before, and I'm not fighting there. I'm there as a coach. You're there as a coach. The night before, something happens in the bar between you and Dennis Hallman. Now, I was right there. I was about 5, 6, 7 feet away. It was just far enough that I couldn't hear. And I know it resulted in you slapping Dennis. So essentially some kind of a barroom fight breaks out. That was it. It wasn't the world's biggest deal, but it was enough that it got a whole bunch of attention. Now this is just the beginning to the story. The next night is the actual fight. Now your guys, you thought, fought pretty well. So there was one of them. His name was Ed. You bought him a beer or two to celebrate his match. I think he even lost the fight, but you were very proud of how he performed. Well, the next thing we know, Lisa Faircloth, who was the most powerful woman in that organization, and she was, I believe, an assistant by title, but she kind of was a jack of all trades. She kind of ran the show. She's now mad at you. She's mad at Don, and now we're backstage. And backstage, something happened where you got pissed off, took your jersey off, threw it down, but what you didn't do is bring a replacement shirt. So now we've got a mildly drunk, angry, topless Don Fry. At this point, you're now face-to-face with Kurt Otto, who's the CEO of the company. Lisa Faircloth walks up, and you say to her with all sincerity, can't you see, let me do it in your voice, can't you see that the men are talking? Now what part of that, what part of that, what part am I remembering wrong? All right.
I don't know, but that sounds like something I would say, yeah.
Now, I think that promptly ended your tenure with the IFL, if I remember correctly. We all ended up, I remember the whole IFL went under not soon thereafter, but I believe that was officially Don Fry's last night.
I believe so, yeah. Yeah.
Did you ever get a shirt, or did you have to walk back or ride back to the hotel topless?
I don't remember. It's so many years ago, I try and forget that whole, shithole part of my life, man. That was just a really piss stain on my memories.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, they were doing some fun stuff, though. And the thing that I liked that was fun from a fan perspective is they were having the coaches fight. Coach versus coach. And I remember there was talk they were going to bring you back. You were retired at that point. They're going to bring you back and have a match. I believe it was against Marco Huaz. And I remember thinking, man, that's awesome. I really want to see that fight.
You know what, man? I was promised so many things by the IFL that never came true. You know? And so many times, one time I went up to Washington because my brother got diagnosed with cancer with two types of cancer, actually.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, lupus and the other one that goes along with it, shit. And so I told them not to call me. I'd be out of touch for a week. You know? And sure as shit, what they do, two days later, they call me up trying to fire one of my guys.
Oh, those bastards.
They're trying to fire two of them. And I said, well, you can fire this one, but not the other one. You know? I said, because the other one, you know, Gabe Rivas. So Gabe Rivas is a good fighter. You know, but the other guy, he can go. You know, the other guy named Gabe. So what they do, they fire Gabe, the one I wanted to keep. And get the other guy because he was a trust fund baby, or his parents had lots of money or something like that. So they were trying to milk him, you know. So then they called up Rivas and told him I said to fire him, you know.
Now, when you say they were trying to milk him, do you mean they were looking for an investor? They wanted his family to invest?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
and, you know, I enjoyed some of the memories I built with that company. I was part of Matt Lindland's team, and it was our real team out here, Team Quest. So, you know, you're traveling the road with the guys. Only good things come from memory of that. But, boy, from a business standpoint, that was suspicious. Yeah, that whole thing stunk. The way that blew up, you know, from nothing to ending as a shell company, the people that cashed out at the timing that they cashed out.
Yeah.
And everybody else was left holding the bag. And that is business. There is risk involved, and I'm not ready to say that there was anything more to it, but there was at least some conversation to be had there. There was certainly speculation.
Oh, there's a lot of word around the campfire. A lot of word around the campfire, you know?
Do you remember?
None of it was good either.
Don, do you remember? And this was the beginning of the end, but the house was already on fire. The stock was already going down, and they brought in a new guy. And the guy became the president of the company. He was purely a boxer, and he referred to MMA as foreplay for gay porn.
No, I don't remember. Who was that?
No, I don't know his name, and he didn't last long because the company didn't last long. But he not only did that, he not only made that statement, but he made it on his first day on the job. In his opening press release, that came out of his mouth.
Wow.
And this is a guy that's representing shareholders. Look, if you want to put a knucklehead in charge, you want him to be the jockey, go ahead. But when it's a publicly traded company, the rules are different. Your obligations and your responsibilities are different, and he should have been fired as quickly as he was hired.
Absolutely. You know, the thing about boxers is they generally top out at a fifth inch, and then they just go downhill from there by receiving all the punches to the head.
Sure.
You know, the MMA fighters, a lot of them have degrees. A lot of them have college education, you know. And pretty much 99.9% of them have a high school education or diploma. So, you know, what do you expect from a boxer?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm surprised he could spell MMA.
I just don't know how you put him in charge. You know, he's a guy that none of us had heard of. He wasn't in the business. He wasn't like, you know, a VP or an executive somewhere that made his way up the ranks. I don't really know how all that happened, but I remember they reached out to me for advice one time. They were kind of just asking me my opinion, and I just said, well, historically, you know, let's start with your ring. A ring has never worked in North America, ever. It has worked in Japan, and I don't fully know why, but in America, we've got to see a cage. Back from the pro wrestling days, the promoter in pro wrestling would charge more money if he was having a cage match somewhere on the card. Americans,
well, appearance-wise, it's more dramatic and more dangerous.
It certainly is. When you walk in, there is an aesthetic appeal to it, and you know something exciting is going on.
It's so much more theatrical. You know, I mean, that's the bottom. It's theatrical. You know.
And I remember when I told them this, they fought with me. Now, I wasn't a guy trying to voice his opinion. They asked me my opinion. And so I told them. And I didn't just back it up with, hey, I don't like the ring. I said, you know, I backed it up with some facts, and I just said it's never worked. There's never been a promotion to come to North America, including Pride. Pride never sold out in America either. I said it just hasn't worked in this country in a ring. In a ring is what we box in or wrestle, professional wrestling. And cages are what we fight in. And, boy, they were madder than hell that I said it. And I said, well, guys, you know, you do owe your shareholders at least to study history and see what works. It's not any more money for a cage than it is a ring. I'm not interested in fighting on this point with you guys, but you've put a boxing guy at your helm. He brought his apparatus. I'm a wrestling guy, Don, as are you. We both wrestled in college, Pac-10, you a little bit in the Big 12 over there at Oklahoma State first. But the point is, I'm not, and you're not, if you start promoting MMA, we're not going to bring in Resolite and roll it out.
No, it's not going to work. They did not want anybody who contradicted their thoughts. All they want to do is surround themselves with yes men. And you know that as well as I do. And the first time anybody posed a question or, you know, an opinion that was different to theirs, you know, they piss themselves and they want to get rid of them.
Yeah, you're right. You know, there was a guy way back in your career, and I can't think of his last name, but his first name was Richard. And he was like a minister or something out in Arizona.
He was a piece of fucking trash, boy.
What happened with that guy?
I believe he went to prison for child molestation is the word I got.
That's the same word that I got. And I also heard, and we'll leave his last name out of it because I can't confirm this, but I also heard that his name was never even Richard, that he'd already done some time. And he was out, and he was masquerading as a minister as a way to kind of get over in the community. And,
and that was from the WPA Witness Protection Program, because apparently he ratted out a bunch of the mobsters back east, and he was in the Witness Protection Program on the run. And this guy's so stupid. What does he want to do? He wants to get on TV, you know, because he's so goddamn greedy and stupid. You know, you can't change the stripes, right?
Right. You know, very early on, I was still in college, but I almost signed with that guy. And I met him one time, but I almost signed with him only because you had. I thought, if Don's with him, then yeah, he must be good.
No, I was with him one fight. And I think I was getting ready for the next fight, and unfortunately, during training for that fight, I broke a kid's nose with an elbow.
That sounds right.
It was a terrible situation. It wasn't intentional, but it appeared intentional because as soon as they said, we were boxing, sparring, as soon as they said break, I hit him with an elbow, busted his nose. So it's one of those questionable calls, and which will always be questionable, even in my mind, because it still bugs me, to this day. And so I went in there to pay him, and he was supposed to take care of the guy, but he said, no, you got to take care of yourself. Don't take care of it. And he says, I said, what are you talking about? I paid you. He says, no, you didn't pay me. You gave me a bonus. I said, what?
Oh, wow.
I paid him 10%, of my purse. It's a bonus, right then and there. I mean, the guy was so freaking greasy, and me and the other kid looked at each other, and I walked out of there. That was it. That never dealt with that piece of trash again.
Wow, that's interesting. Now, when you go back in that day, what was your relationship with Dan Severn? Was he coaching you at one point at Arizona State?
Yeah, Dan was the assistant wrestling coach on there. Bobby is a great coach, and Dan was the assistant, my freshman year. And then, after that, he got hired by Michigan State, so he went there, went back home. But, that's where I met Dan, and we kind of buddied up, and I worked with him throughout the summer, assembling and delivering Olympic weight machines,
Right. And Becky Levi, she was running in that crowd for a while, wasn't she?
Yeah, I brought Becky in. Because strength and conditioning wise, so I brought her in as a strength and conditioning coach. And she did a great job for me.
She's awesome. She doesn't get enough credit. She's one of those people that was around early and got out before the boom. She actually gave me my break in MMA. She was putting on a tournament. I believe her and Dan Severn were partners, but it was called Danger Zone. And that's back in the tournament day. And it was a four-man tournament. I had to fight two guys on one night. But, I couldn't get in. There was no fights going on. There was no opportunity. Twitter and Facebook and all these things didn't exist. So I tracked down her email address, sent her a message out of the blue, and she threw me in the tournament. So I've always been appreciative of her, but I have no updates. You know what she's doing now?
We had a splitting of the ways because we both had rather large egos, we just had a difference of opinion and went our own ways.
All right, I got you. I heard she was in Japan, like teaching English or something. I don't know if that's accurate, but totally out of MMA, as I understand it.
Yeah, well, I heard her back, but she had a bad back. Because she was an alternate on the one or two Olympic teams for shot put and discus, something like that. And then she did judo. She's really phenomenal at judo. And then her back started going real bad on her.
Right. Wow. I didn't know that. I didn't know that had happened to her. So give me some scoop, man. Give me some crazy story that happened behind the scenes. Tell me something that happened in Japan.
That first fight with Gilbert Ivel, is what, September 23rd, 2001, 2 weeks after September 11th, and I fought Gilbert, and he tried taking both eyeballs home,
That's a dirty son of a bitch right there.
Yeah, I'm glad he fought me like that, because what happened is, Brian Johnson had a stroke a few weeks ahead, or a month ahead, and so they called me to finish Johnson's tour, the pro wrestling. I said, okay, I'm getting ready for a fight, so I got to have a workout partner come with me, and so they allowed that, and eventually got that guy a job with the pro wrestling, and that guy ended up being just a turd. And so my last wrestling match against Scott Norton, a week before the fight, I tried some kind of stupid flip. I ended up straining or pulling my adductor. And so I took a few days off, and then my team shows up, and we start working out, and I pulled it. And so we had to take a few more days off, and you know, before the fight, and going to work out. Going to last 4 days for the fight. And so come fight time, they wrapped it up, you know, taped it up, wrapped it up, and shot with lidocaine, you know, in my adductor. And I lived out there. And, you know, all Gibber had to do is just jab me and kick me, and he'd have won because I could barely move. You know, there's no side movement at all. And all I could do, I could just go forward. And thank God he's a tough fighter. He'd come to fight, or else, you know, if he'd have ran like everybody does in MMA now, you know, boys. And so he got DQ'd, and I back to the medical room, you know, and they're checking out my eyeballs because they're completely worthless. And next thing I know, there's a bunch of yelling and screaming going on. I hear Gilbert's voice. He charged into the room. So I jump up off the table, and I thought we were going to go at it again, you know. But he just, you know, he was coming in to, you know, make good because they took like 40 or 50% of his purse. You know?
Right. You know, but they have to. You got to do something. The guy was beyond dirty. And there's one thing to go out there and you're a little fast and loose with the rules. You try to get away with something. There's another guy thing to poke opponent in the eye, gouging it, where you're purposely putting your finger in there and leaving it as you're digging at a guy's eye. And you weren't the only guy he did that to. He was just a dirty son of a bitch. He was a big, mean guy. He wasn't much of a fighter. As far as a talent goes, he was next to worthless, but he was big enough and mean enough that you had to take him serious.
Well, I think he's a pretty good fighter. Shit. You know,
he's a bomb. Gilbert was a bomb. Yeah, go look at his record. The guy's a bomb. But okay. He was still a guy that you had to take serious because he would go out there and fight, and he'll poke you in the eye. He'll do whatever it took to win. It didn't help him. He still never won. But you're right. He was a problem.
Right, but, you know, I mean, hey, that's life. You know, I mean, they pulled me over to the corner, the doctor started checking out my eyes, you know, and they were all sad and everything, and then they said, how do you feel? I said, I can't see, and then all of a sudden the other voice in my head said, shut up, Fry, you know, because once a fighter, you know, gets out of his game, once a fighter starts complaining, he's out, he's gone.
Yep.
You know? So I said, shut up, Fry, get back into it. And I says, hey, let's fight. And they go, what? I said, let's fight. Okay. So we did it. You know, we finished the fight.
Yep. No, man, that's what you were known for. I mean, I still remember you being caught in a heel hook, dead to rights, by Ken Shamrock. And not only did you not surrender by tapping, you didn't even make a facial expression. You kept your face completely blank. I'm sitting in my living room going, well, I can see that his knee's torn up, but he apparently doesn't seem to care.
Well, hell, I talked so much smack about Ken Shamrock, I wasn't about to, you know, to buckle or fold. Heck, I had to let him take it home with him.
Yeah, that was a great match. Where's your guys' relationship today? Do you guys stay in touch?
You know, we don't send each other Christmas cards, you know, but we say hello or very genial and see each other.
Now, when you talk about pride, how many of those matches, in your estimate, if you were to put a percentage on it, 10%, 20%, whatever the number is, how many of those matches were worked? How many of them did the promoters already know ahead of time what the outcome was going to be?
You know, I don't know, partner, because I was so into my own little world. You know, you want to talk to somebody, you know, people ask me about this, that, and everything. You got to talk to Steve Owen. He's my, you know, my trainer, my quarterman. He knew what was going on around the goddamn hotel because it got on fire, and I wouldn't know it, you know, because sure. I was so, had such tunnel vision, you know, trying to concentrate on myself and concentrating on the fight. I didn't know what was going on around me.
Did they ever approach you, Don? Did they ever tell you, hey, we want you to lose this one?
No, they didn't, but they, you know, they sure shit changed the opponents on me, you know, 3-4 times, you know, on several of my fights. So, but, you know, I figured that's just the fight game, you know?
Sure.
What difference does it make? You got to fight them all anyways.
Yeah. No, man, I understand that, and I came through that. I was just behind you. You were in the UFC and setting the world on fire in the mid-90s, but I was doing some stuff on the amateur circuit all the way back then. And I had a fight, my first ever amateur fight, a guy named Trevor Pranglin. I ended up rematching him in the UFC. So it was a damn hard fight, for an amateur match. But the fight was scheduled for 7 minutes. And I whipped Trevor from pillar to post. And at 7 minutes and 34 seconds into a seven-minute fight, he puts me in a move called a triangle choke that I'd never seen then. And he chokes me out. Now, this is 34 seconds after time had ran out. But what the promoter said, he goes, you know, it's just such a good fight. I wanted to see more of it. There was no commissions back then. And I didn't complain. I got it. I'm like, yeah, that was a good fight. I don't blame you for that. Now, in hindsight, now I look back and go, wait a minute, you can't do that. But the way it was then, and the way that, you know, you and I were coming through, particularly as wrestlers, where we didn't get anything, we didn't care what the rules were, we just wanted to compete with somebody.
It's, right.
We just don't complain.
Right.
So when I talk about pride, though, and I talk about that there was fixed matches, and I realize you're not weighing in on that, but I'm not wrong to say that pride had fixed matches, am I?
You know what? I don't know if they had them fixed or they had them, you know, balanced so much in one guy's favor or not. You know, I mean, you got to look at some of the opponents Bob Sapp had. You know, and some of the other guys, they had some pretty easy fights out there.
Sure.
You know.
And you know,
I wasn't lucky enough to be one of them, I guess.
I hear you, and you know, I remember when Rulon was getting ready to fight out there. He was going to fight Takata, Olympic champ versus Olympic champ. And all they asked of Rulon, they didn't ask him to go down, they didn't ask for an outcome, but they did come in and offer him $10,000 to not throw any punches, or rather, not to take him down. We will give you $10,000 right now, just on your word, but you cannot take this guy down. Rulon turned it down. He did take the guy down. And he won the fight, but that was the kind of stuff that they would do. And that's shady, that's fugazi. And in our industry, which is so tight-knit, you go make an offer like that, it gets through the whole industry quickly.
Right.
So the referee in Pride would wear an earpiece. He would have an ear pack on and an earpiece. For me, as a fan, that's a problem. In a straight-up competitive event, you don't need an earpiece. Now, in professional wrestling, the referee does. One, because he's talking to the guys, but two, because it's a show, he needs to tell them when it's time to go home, which means get the pinfall and get to the locker room.
Tell you God's honest truth, I never, until now, never noticed that he had the earpiece.
Well, now that I bring it to your attention, don't you kind of scratch your head and go, yeah, that's weird. Who's instructing the referee?
Right. Absolutely.
Now, tell me what the hardest you've ever been hit is. And before you tell me, I want to guess. I'm going to guess that you say Tank Abbott in 1996.
Yeah, I would say either Tank Abbott or Jerome LeBanner. Yeah, I'm just, you know, I have to go with LeBanner because I don't even remember that fight, you know?
But that was K-1 rules, correct?
Correct.
You know, you brought up Bob Sapp earlier. I really felt that Bob Sapp had discredited the K-1. Now, this isn't a knock to Bob, but so many people will brag about a guy having K-1 skills. And I'm looking at going, I don't know what the big deal is. K-1 is not, for me, feel free to disagree. For me, K-1 is not a great striking event. It's a striking-only event. But you're not going to get a great striker to go fight three guys in one night for a $50,000 check that generally bounced. And when you get a guy like Bob Sapp, who had limited skills but was a monster, to go out and win the K-1 on three separate occasions, I thought it hurt. I thought it made him look bad.
I got to disagree with you because I've been hit. I got hit by LeBanner. And I'll guarantee you it hurts.
For sure.
Know?
Well, and I imagine if you got hit by Bob Sapp, it would too. But I'm just saying I'm not saying those guys aren't good strikers. I'm not saying that, but there is a reason that they don't convert well to MMA, and there's a reason that they're not making money fighting at Caesar's Palace, you know, in boxing, too. It's a very unique sport.
Wait, but you know, once you get a skill set, Jill, you know you get a skill set in your mind. That's why, you know, I was an average wrestler in college. You know, you were a national champion, what, once or twice?
Twice, but it was Greco. I was an All-American by college standards.
Okay, I was average, okay? So I didn't have it stuck in my mind like, you know, some of these Olympic gold medalists do. That come, you know, the Olympic gold medalist wrestlers, and they come into MMA and they get slaughtered, you know, because they can't make the distinction between a takedown and an armbar. You know, they take somebody down, you know, in wrestling, they usually roll through their stomach and push off trying to escape, whereas, you know, you take them down and the fight game, well, they stay on their back and they go for a submission. So, I mean, you saw Kenny Monday get arm-barred by Frank Shamrock in 20 seconds, right?
Sure.
Yeah, because Kenny come in there, hey, I'm a gold medalist, Olympic gold medalist, and, you know, my shit don't stink, and I'll take him down. And, okay, fine, that's the name of the game, take me down. That's where these jiu-jitsu guys won't be anyway.
Sure.
You know?
The fight you're thinking of was actually Kevin Jackson. He and Monday were Olympic team partners. I knew who you meant, but yeah, I remember that. I remember when Frank swung in that armbar against KJ, and all of us were sitting at home, never seen Kevin Jackson lose in our lives, and it was over. It was over in less than a minute.
Right.
You know, Don, you're seeing more of that, though, in terms of wrestling just not working anymore. I mean, to clarify those words, it's certainly not enough. It used to be a real simple factor. The better wrestler is going to win. Man, that's just not true anymore.
Well, you know, I mean, God bless the Gracies, because they made me a wheelbarrow full of money. They made you a wheelbarrow full of money. You know, people badmouth them, but God bless them. I'm glad they came out here. They changed the way the world looked at martial arts and the way the world looked at fighting. You know?
Now, back to your welcome.
You get knocked on your butt and guy jumps on top of you, let's keep going. It's not the end of it. You know, it's just beginning.
That's right.
And that's what a lot of people, you know, back then couldn't comprehend.
Yeah. And, you know, you really got to trick a guy to take him down anymore. The setup is far more important than the shot itself. Did you have a chance to watch Johnny Hendricks against Robbie Lawler?
Yeah. I thought Robbie won the first fight, and then I thought Johnny won the second fight. You know, I thought the judges got the decisions completely screwed up. You know,
I don't know that I would disagree with you on that, but I think we can both acknowledge they were pretty damn close. You know, I really didn't know whose hand they were going to raise until they raised it. Is that where you were?
No. I'll stand where I'm saying, man. I'm telling you, I thought Robbie won the first fight hands down, and I thought Johnny won the second fight hands down.
Wow. See, I saw them both as very tight, and I did think that Johnny had won the second fight, but I really didn't know. You know, it was close enough. I was sitting with a group of guys at ESPN, and I said, you know, on a 10-9 muscle, Johnny Lawler outpunched him, outkicked him, out-wrestled him, out-submission attempted him, kicked him, beat him up. But he only did it in rounds 2 and 3, and he did it bad. He whipped him real bad in those rounds. The other ones were so tight that they could tip to Lawler, and if they do, that's 3-2 Lawler, and that is how the judges had it.
I'm not sure about submission attempts are really not, because you know what? How about punching attempts?
Yeah.
What if I stood 5 feet away from you and start throwing jabs?
Sure.
You know, so that's a punch attempt. You know, but throw a kick, that's a kick attempt. You know, just because you're 5 feet away and they don't connect, it's not my fault, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what's with the submission attempt? You either get it or you don't, man. It's like a takedown. I don't agree with takedown attempts, you know. I agree with stalling, you know. Jesus, the guy's stalling, but, you know, or defending the takedown, but there's no such thing as an attempt. You either got it or you don't.
Well, I agree with that. And even though I mentioned submission attempts, and as analysts and commentators will do that, the reality is the judges don't have to acknowledge that. It's very subjective. A judge can maybe one gives weight, but maybe one doesn't. In fact, they try to talk about changing judging and holding classes and setting criteria. I disagree with that, and I know judging can use some help here or there, but I don't like the idea of that, because you're going to get a guy that comes in with a wrestling background that insists to everybody that the takedown's worth X amount, and you're going to get a guy with a jiu-jitsu background that insists an attempt. But I'm with you. You know, if I throw a super hard punch at you, Don, that had it landed would have knocked you out, but it doesn't land, I shouldn't be awarded for that.
Right. Right. Oh, what a vicious near mess, right?
Yeah. Oh, exactly. Now, you know, I do want to go back to something, Don. We're talking about Gilbert Ivel earlier. And, you know, I bashed him a little bit. I called him a bum. That's because I had my own personal run-in with the guy outside of MMA. I had it at an event, actually standing in a buffet line where I was holding the plate in my hand thinking, maybe I shouldn't have put this corned beef on it because I might need to throw this across the thing and use it like a Frisbee to hit this knucklehead. But you bring up Gilbert Ivel, and you bring up the eye pokes. We're seeing a lot of that in the UFC. We're seeing it, you know, whether it was Chuck Liddell days or now in the John Jones days, we're just seeing these eye pokes. And they're accidental. They're not like what Gilbert did. But what do you think? I mean, how paramount is it? How much of a necessity does the UFC or MMA as a whole need to get a new glove?
I don't know. But you know what? I'm questioning the John Jones accidental. Call, because come on, the guy's world champion multiple times. He's defended the belt. You tell me he doesn't know enough to close his freaking hand and make a fist, you know, 6 inches away from your head.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I think it's really questionable.
Well, and the big cop out there, if you're a referee, the cop out is to the defensive fighter. The oldest rule in the book, which is protect yourself at all times. It's like, you know, I get that. I think that's fair. But at the same time, if it's your hand and your finger, you've got to be responsible for where it goes. And even if it is an accident, a precedent does need to be set. You know, you take a point from one guy and it costs him a fight, which it would do in a three round.
Everybody's going to start making the fist. You're
that
damn
night.
Right.
It'll happen
be aware.
That night. That's exactly it.
Open awareness.
That's exactly it. You know, as soon as you take those, come on, it's going to end that. And I don't care if the guy's an undercard or a main event. If you don't stop the fight and warn him, you don't punish his opponent. And in America, that's what the opponent ends up getting punished, particularly in the court of public opinion. A guy named Darren Kershank is going through that now. He's poked in the eye. His eye was poked so bad that he needs surgery on it. And he didn't want to fight with one eye. So he said, look, I'm done. I can't go on. And the crowd turned on him. Now, I don't. As a guy that's, you know, I recognize a guy's only got two eyes. There's very few parts of your body that you need to protect more than your eyes.
Right.
And if you can't see, I don't fault him in the least. But something has to be done. And it's got to be, look, it's your finger, it's your hand, you control where it goes. It's as simple as that. And if you don't, even if it's an accident, you're losing a point.
That's right.
All right, Don. I've got to move on with my day unless you've got anything to tell me.
Not a damn thing, Brenda. Not a damn thing.
Well, I will tell you on a personal note, man, I love seeing your success. I enjoy seeing you in the movies. It's always a kick when you pop into a commercial and I look up and go, man, that's Don Fry. So keep up the good work, pal.
All right, Brenda. Thanks. Congratulations on the podcast.
Couldn't have happened to a better guy. Number one. Don, we're number one this week.
Oh, great. Now you're going to be number one for a month. We'll just keep replaying yours and my conversation.
That's exactly right. I think that's a good idea. Thank you, buddy.
All right, partner. Bye-bye.
All right, guys. Don Fry, what a fun guy. What a fun guy to have on. He'll call it like it is. I was hoping to get a little more of him out of the Pride days. I don't like when I come out and tarnish Pride, even though it deserves it. I like it when the guys from Pride do it, and I tried to dangle that carrot in front of him, but I thought he was pretty candid when he said, look, I was focused on myself, and there was some stuff going on, but I didn't see it. Guys, that was Don Fry. Follow him on Twitter. I'll have to look up his Twitter handle. I don't have it, but I know he's out there. He tweeted me this morning. I could almost hear his voice coming through as I read those 140 characters. Stick around, guys. More You're Welcome. More Chael Sonnen, and I will be joined by John Trotsky. Stick around, guys. When you're ready to buy a car, True Car is changing car buying forever. Yes, True Car helps car buyers get rid of the fear that they might overpay. Every day, True Car users receive negotiation-free guaranteed savings, and True Car users save an average of $3,221 off of MSRP. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. First, download the True Car mobile app or go to TrueCar.com. To find out what others paid for the car that you want, then register to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Third step is simple. Take your guaranteed savings certificate to the True Car certified dealer for a better hassle-free car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. With True Car, you can save time, save money, and never overpay. To see how much you can save on the car you want, simply download the True Car mobile app or visit TrueCar.com today.
What did Dan Patrick and Rich Eisen have to say about the NFL playoffs?
Which team in the NFC field do you believe has the best chance to go up there to the Pacific Northwest and knock the crown off their heads?
Dallas. I think Dallas is able to run. You got to run the football.
Catch them both here every day at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.
All right, we are back for more You're Welcome. Made a good decision tuning in today, guys, and you're about to get even more of a treat. I got John Trotsky on the line. John, what's going on, buddy?
Not much. How are you doing, Chael?
Yeah, never better. Still famous and still rich. Thanks for bringing it up.
Well, someday I hope to be there with you.
Hey, man, listen, you got a really cool thing going on, and for our listeners listening in, and all of your fans, and I appreciate all of the Twitter support. People have been pretty pumped that you've been going to come on the show here today. But you're in New York, and I know that your heart is with pro wrestling, but you follow MMA as well. What is the beat of a fellow New Yorker like yourself on legalizing and bringing MMA to New York?
I feel that it's a very good thing to do. I mean, that's something everybody gets very, very excited about. It's amazing sport, and I absolutely think that it's a good thing. You know, I mean, I have nothing but great things to say about that.
And you know, it's funny. You got to deal with this anywhere you are listening in the country. We've all got politicians, and they all make votes, and we have decisions. I don't have a problem with a politician doing something that I disagree with. I really don't. What I do have a problem with is a politician lying. And when a politician in New York comes out and says, "Oh, well, we're not going to do MMA," and then they fill in the blanks. When the reality is it's a union issue that goes on in Nevada with the culinary union. This is well documented. The culinary union doesn't even make a secret about it. They brag about it. This is not any... The politician should just come out and say it. They should just come out, be clean. Go, listen, this is politics, okay? We get a lot of funding from the unions. There's a union issue in Las Vegas. If they can get that cleared up, we'd love to have MMA come to the city. But it doesn't hurt us. In my opinion, we don't need New York. But New York sure could use us. We can go 6 miles underneath the bridge and go to Governor Christie's state, and we do it all the time. But in exchange, Governor Christie and the people from New Jersey get the tax dollars. That's a problem for New York, not for us.
Yeah, I agree. I agree 100%. And that's... I don't know why it's taking this long to make this all happen, to be very honest.
Yeah, and I also get a kick out of some of the misconceptions where they feel that they're hurting the UFC. If we can keep them at Madison Square Garden, that would sell out. It would do such a big gate. We can hurt the UFC. If we played that venue, we could do it without charging for tickets. That isn't the business model. You know, we could sell out anywhere, and in this case, we do. We go over to Atlantic City, or we go into Trenton, or we go somewhere in New Jersey, and we fill it up with East Coasters, New Jerseys, and a lot of New Yorkers. It doesn't hurt business. It's just cool. To get it into New York, that's a cool thing to do, but that's where it ends.
Yeah, no, it would be an amazing thing. I'd love to go see any event that is MMA-related at the Madison Square Garden. I mean, that's the mecca. I mean, as a professional wrestler, that is our mecca. And as MMA come in there, I think it would shake some things up, and I think it would really be a good thing for every business in the city. And I think that that's something that absolutely you know, what needs to be done.
Well, I had a great time a week ago. This is when I came up to you and I said, hey, why don't you come on my podcast? I was over at a pro wrestling event. I was at the Sanctuary, which is your promotion and your venue. Why don't you tell us a little about that?
Okay, yeah, sure. I actually bought a very old graystone church in Hazleton, Pennsylvania. It's about 2 hours from New York City, maybe an hour and a half north from Philadelphia. And I've converted the inside of this church into a giant professional wrestling arena. Basically, I'm following the model of WWE as far as their developmental ground and their performance center down in Full Sail University. And I'm really trying to tie in Penn State University, where I teach as a professor. I'm trying to basically make a replica of that NXT and a replica of the performance center. And it's really, it's been coming along amazingly so. I've only done six shows. And the fan following and the support and the internet reach it's been getting has been absolutely incredible. It's a lot of times in independent wrestling, you go to these VFW halls or you go to some old high school gym, and without sounding disrespectful to some of the wrestlers that wrestle on them, you see a bunch of guys that have, frankly, I got no nice way of saying it, guys that have no business being in a professional wrestling ring wrestling these things. My company and what I'm doing here is all... Everybody looks like they could be in WWE. You know, everybody is there performing and enhancing themselves to basically take the next step up to the next level. And it's been an incredible journey so far. And January 25th, I got my next show, which is we're doing a Royal Rumble-style show. Again, we kind of follow the WWE model there. And it's going to be a really, really incredible thing. We're going to crown our first champion. And the energy in this building, I'm sure you know it from when you were there, it has a vibe. It's a palatable energy, and I think it's partly because it's inside of a church, and just between the lighting and the smoke, and it makes you feel like you're at a rock concert, you know? And it's something really, really special that we're doing here in PA, and really and truly, I appreciate you helping me get the word out about the place.
Yeah, man, that was actually my experience when I was there. It was just a positive energy, and when I was watching the young guys that were wrestling, I thought, well, you know, I'm watching tomorrow's talent. These guys are going to be TV ready in no time. But that's got to be a little bit of a concern for you as a promoter when you build those guys and they become big enough. They move on.
My goal in this business is basically, listen, I am no Steve Austin or anybody that's ever going to be a huge wrestler. I am somebody who was a very solid wrestler in my day, and because of, unlike most wrestlers, I went and got an education and actually have two master's degrees. I'm able to tie in everything I do at my college inside of that center, and I'm not worried about, you know, my guys leaving. In fact, I hope they use it as a stepping stone. Back in the day, there was ECW where they grabbed, WWE and WCW just grabbed guys from left and right. That's what I want my place to be. I'm not in competition with Vince McMahon. I'm not in competition with TNA. I am just forming my own little developmental breeding ground where you're going to see the guys that will end up on NXT next. You know, I got a lot of fantastic talent in this place. A lot of guys that, again, you know, you got an Anthony Bowens. I got a Damian Gibbs. I got Atu, the God King. I got guys there that I know will someday see, you know, big mainstream television. And frankly, you know, as a smart guy, I know how to produce talent, you know, and I got to circle it out. So, I mean, yeah, I have no problem with WWE or anybody else scooping up my talent.
No, that's so good. I think that's a great outlook. I think that's an open and honest and a really great outlook. I'm from the Northwest, and we had one of the top promoters in the country many years ago, rest his soul, named Don Owen. But Don was very careful to not let his guys become too big. He wouldn't let the publications come in and write about them and put them in the magazines because he didn't want Vince to scoop them up. And it was a smart business move, but it held his guys back. And a lot of them did come through. A number of them did make it over there from Crush of Demolition, Brian Adams, you know, Jimmy Snuka, all the Billy Jack Haynes, these guys, all Browdy, Roddy Piper. They all came through Don Owen's promotion, but Don strategically held them down.
That is not the purpose of this place at all. Again, Douglas Crosby, the genius, basically named the place the Sanctuary, and, you know, in a combined vision with him, we basically just want to do something good for professional wrestling. I remember when we trained Mickey Rourke on The Wrestler, Mickey and me and Doug all talked about how can we give back to professional wrestling? How can we make this sport better? And God bless Doug, who brought me on many movies, getting me stunt gigs left and right. You know, he made me financially be able to make this happen. And frankly, this is my donation to pro wrestling. I'm not here to make money. This is not about me or anything else. This is all about moving the business forward. And it's really, I'm doing cyber clinics, something that's never been done in pro wrestling, where I'm bringing in legends and veterans, and I'm putting them up on my, I have a 22-inch video or 22-foot video screen in there, like the old Monday Night Raw set. And I put the wrestlers up on Skype, and they basically do clinics with my guys in the ring. And they basically, I have a full production set up at all times in that building. So they see a five-camera, multi-cam thing from their homes on Skype, and then give the wrestlers advice on how to improve themselves.
That's smart.
You know, it's a fantastic setting. Eventually, I'm going to make this place have, because of the IST side of my career, I'm going to make this a virtual arena, like that Oculus Rift headset. I'm going to set up something in there that somebody's going to feel like you're going to be able to sit out in Oregon, and you're going to be able to put on your Oculus Rift, and you're going to feel like you're inside my venue.
You know, there is good. Oh, you know, John, I was on. You brought up Mickey Rourke and training him for The Wrestler. I was on the set of The Wrestler, and by set,
you
and I both know that means a ring set up in Darren Aronofsky's office.
That's exactly what it was.
And it was awesome, and that's where you guys would train. In fact, I just had Don Fry on right before you called in, and Don Fry was out there. I don't know if you remember him, but Don Fry was part of the...
Big Don Fry. I love Big Don.
That's exactly right. I've been doing that all day, too. It's hard to hear Don's voice and then not want to copy him. I used to think that was an act, like Randy Savage's voice, but knowing Don 15 years, that's just how he speaks.
Yeah.
God bless him.
He's a walking, talking cartoon character. You know, I know people call you a character, but that man is Yosemite Sam, walking and talking. I love it.
No, he absolutely is. And you brought up Douglas Crosby. Now, he had a small program. He is a genius. But he had a small program lined up called the New Yorkers. My buddy Stephen Quinn got a New Yorker shirt for Christmas from Douglas, and I've been waiting for this to come out, but the New Yorkers haven't debuted. What's the holdup?
The New Yorkers will debut, and we are trying to strategically make it work within the storylines of the company. Something that most independent wrestling companies, when they run shows, they basically just do spot shows. They run in a VFW hall in a high school, and it's just a show for that town for that day. Everything I do is, I am the perfect hybrid of sports entertainment and professional wrestling. And I'm taking all the knowledge that I get up from on the movie set on how they script every single thing that they do out. And I'm not calling wrestling fake by any means, because you've been in wrestling rooms. You know how hard guys hit, and you know how the bumps feel. It's gymnastics. It's super high-end cheerleading with falls. And I got no problem in saying that. But everything has to follow a perfect script. And I got to make sure that when the New Yorkers make their debut, it creates a moment. Because in professional wrestling, I truly believe all that this business is about is creating emotionally exploitive moments.
Sure.
Which, frankly, that's the entertainment business.
That's entertainment.
What do you watch TV for? You get it so you feel something inside because your in life sucks, and you use that for an escape. That's what I'm doing here with pro wrestling, you know. And Doug and the New Yorkers will make their debut, and they will make it in a very impactful way that has meaning.
All right, so let me ask you something, and I'm going to ask you this based on geography. Again, because you're from New York, when I look at the Garner case, I look at the five cops brought him down, and he later died.
Yep.
All right. I feel like the narrative on this, and I feel like the narrative, even on the Mike Brown case in Ferguson, it's just off. When I watch it and I study it, I'm going, man, those aren't the questions that I have. Those aren't the takeaways that I have. And in the Garner case, let me give you an example. My takeaway isn't that the cops brought him down or thought that they needed to cut. It's none of that. Where I have a problem and where I've never gotten an answer, and I want to know if you agree with me as a New Yorker. My problem with that is that five police officers were assigned to one guy committing a nonviolent crime. Regardless of what happens after that, whether he's alive and well today, as he should be, or whether he took the route that we've all heard, I got a problem that the most crime-ridden city in America had a police captain assign five guys in broad daylight to go and accost a guy who's committing a nonviolent crime. And that's not being discussed. Is that being discussed in New York? Do you guys talk about it as you walk around?
It's an absolutely huge issue up here. But here's the thing. I think it's been made in, obviously, via media. It's been turned into a race issue. And I don't think it has... while there's absolutely race involved in this, because I don't think five cops would have had to take down a white guy for selling cigarettes. I mean, that's putting that on the record. But the situation is, why the hell are we assigning five cops to deal with somebody peddling cigarettes?
Right.
You know what I mean?
That's
like, there
the question.
There are so many real laws to attack, and there are so many really violent crimes in that city. And that's the reason why I keep, you know, I'm up in the city and I do my stuff up there, but I keep my home here in, you know, Pennsylvania in the woods, because, frankly, there is a violence issue up there, and it's a little chaotic. So, I mean, when we're dealing with the police officers on the streets harassing people, I mean, really and truly, for tax evasion, essentially the crime that he was committing is you're not paying taxes on those cigarettes that you're selling individually. That would be like me at Halloween going out and opening up the little Skittles packets and then selling Skittles on the street that say, not for individual resale. It's a bullshit crime that really and truly, it should never have happened, and it should never have played out the way it did.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Is there a race issue involved? Yeah, but, you know, we could blow up on that conversation all day.
Yeah, and I don't see it that way either. You know, I never get too hung up on the race thing. I'm able to kind of close my eyes and just replace the players, whether they're all black, they're mixed, this guy's white, whatever it is. And if I can do that and still objectively come away with the same decision, I think that's the simple best way to handle that, to find out, okay, am I saying this because I'm angry about race or not? But this has nothing to do with race. He could be black or white. It should have happened. The cops should not.
Correct.
There just shouldn't have been five of them. And, you know, the other thing is, and I really wasn't looking to go in this direction, but since we're here, they jumped him. You know, if you and I are face-to-face, and things begin to escalate, and eventually you attack me, that's not great. But that is a little bit better if we're face-to-face and things escalate. This guy was standing there, and the only defense that he put up was gravity. He never pushed, punched. The only thing he had, defensive-wise, was that his 2 feet were on the ground and that gravity was pulling him there, and they had to take him down. I'm okay with all of it. I don't necessarily get it, but I don't know what the rules are. I don't know what in the hell they can do. I got a problem when five guys attack one, and I don't think that the answer has to be life and death.
He's not that big. I mean, the guy was a big guy, but I mean, dude, if you're a cop, fucking be a man about
things.
Thank you. You don't need five guys.
Thank you. That's my whole thing. It's like, you know, you bring him before a grand jury and you want to talk about whether he did a murder or not. I don't think he did, but I also don't think that's the debate. I don't think it's either he did a murder or he followed the code. And no, I think there's some middle ground. Look, let's at least all agree these five cops are wimps. And that's not great to say. We need to appreciate the police, and I understand that. But there has to be a case where they get something has to come. They can't just go on about, look, you five guys are wimps. There's five of you. You're armed, and you jumped him. He didn't know it was coming. You did, and you still couldn't take him down?
And beyond that, you needed to use a rear naked choke. One of the, again, you and I both know how dangerous that move is. You and I both know what you can do to somebody with that, with one guy,
sure.
Not five. One guy that ends, I think when we used to do it at the Wild Smart Training Center where I graduated from, Pops used to, when we graduated, put the rear naked choke on us and choke us out. And I remember he explained it basically saying, you know, within 2 seconds, you're unconscious. Within, I think it's 15 seconds, you stop breathing completely. And within 30 seconds, your heart stops if you don't let go of that. So, I mean, that is a very, 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 very serious hold. And there was no, when you have five guys, how about one guy grabs each limb without, you know, there's no need for any of this. It's a ridiculous, the entire scenario is ridiculous.
Well, John, go watch the video. They did. One guy was on his right leg, one on his left, one on his right arm, one on his left. The cop that grabbed him by the head, that was the only thing left to grab. You couldn't lock around the guy's body. You didn't. But if you do, you bulldog him down like a headlock. You know a headlock.
Yeah.
I know. It's totally different to choke him. Now, I'm not mad. I'm not saying that they should have done more to the cop. I don't know enough about the case. But I do know enough to know there was a time when cops were men. Okay, there was a time when they were cowboys and they were men and they had respect. And if you wore that badge, it meant something. You didn't need five guys to go jump a guy. I'm not mad at the cops that are shooting unarmed people. And the reason
is
an
honor code, and they're just not following an honor code. Again, there's a man honor code, and exactly what you said. They were cowboys, and they were just men, and they stood up for what a man should be.
Right.
And now it seems just like we got disgruntled people that are just like bullies of cops, and that's just silliness.
Yeah, but I think you got to back it up. You know, they did this same thing with 9/11. when 9/11 came down, we hear about these guys that came through Boston, that came through New York, they got box cutters onto planes. What we've never heard about to this day is who let them on the plane. What is the name of the TSA agents and what happened to them? What kind of new training did they go through? What kind of penalties? What kind of disciplinary action happened? And the reason we haven't heard is because nothing happened. The guys on 9/11 in both Boston and in New York that let those guys on the plane, that missed those box cutters, that didn't catch them at security, nothing happened. No new training, no disciplinary action, no go home for a little bit. And I'm not the guy that's against the cop. I'm honestly not. I'm on the other side of it. I always take the cop side, and I'm not necessarily against him here in terms of should he have been indicted. But at the very least, John, I think we all need to agree they're wimps. There was five of you armed, and there was one of him, and you guys knew it was coming. That changes everything. If you walk by me and you punch me, it's completely different than if you walk up to me, things escalate, and then you punch me.
I agree. And again, in both cases, this and the one in Ferguson on this wimps topic, both of the cops ended up saying in court, oh, he was like Hulk Hogan, or oh, he was like Andre the Giant. Be a man. You know what? If you're a police officer, lift some weights then, dude. You know?
Like, right.
God forbid. Yeah, it's these guys are not, and again, I'm somebody that's in the exact same case that you are. I have some of my best friends in the world are police officers, and there are so many respectable police officers. And I think part of the narrative that's been lost on this has been all of the good cops out there, because now America, unfortunately, because of the national media, looks at police officers and be like, oh, you're a bunch of dicks. No, they're not. You know, most cops, 99.9% of cops are good.
For sure.
Unfortunately, these five guys getting caught on videotape just look like assholes and ruin it for the bunch.
Yeah, but
and
you're completely right. I mean, totally. We've got an appreciation and thank you, cops, for doing your job. And they're underpaid and underthanked. And I get all of that. But these five guys, like I said, I'm not particularly mad at that. I'm confused, but I'm not particularly mad about it. But I am mad at the police chief. I mean, how did this work before they went out there? Did they go into a briefing room and the cop used a JPEG projector and put up this guy's picture and said, hey, we got to go take him down? Or was there more that meets the eye? Was there something far more serious and they just haven't released it? I mean, I don't buy that.
From my understanding, this guy was a repeat offender for selling cigarettes. And this is something that he's been caught doing several times. Yeah, yeah. And this is something that, you know, really and truly, there was no need to escalate this situation. They should have done the exact same thing they did the past 20 times, which, you know, it's like, oh, okay, well, you know, eventually we got to bring them down. It's a slap on the wrist crime. It's like getting jaywalking. Are you going to choke somebody out for jaywalking, dude?
No, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. All right, I'm done being on my soapbox on that, but, you know, you're the first guy from New York, aside from Douglas, I've talked to. I just wanted to know the feel out there. You know, I'm from a small town out here, Westland, Oregon. But, man, that wouldn't fly. If something like that happened, we wouldn't just look at the case. We'd want to know what happened earlier in the day. We'd say somebody, some dispatch somewhere approved of this, approved of five guys in the most crime-ridden city in America to go over and do this. Your time is better served walking up and down the beach picking up litter than it is to go bother Garner, who's selling some off-brand cigarettes out of a shoebox.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely 100% right on all this.
All right, buddy.
There's an accountability gap.
There is an accountability gap. John Trosky, Sanctuary. Tell us when the next show is.
All right, our next show is January 25th. Anybody that wants to find out more information about the Sanctuary, we are Sanctuary PATV on Twitter and Facebook.com, Sanctuary PA. We have a great show coming up January 25th. For anybody that's looking to become a professional wrestler, I have by far the absolute cheapest rates in the business to train guys. Because, again, I'm not doing this for really the money or anything like that. $100 a month to train people. You know, I make people sign up for a two-year commitment, basically, because, Chael, you understand this as an MMA fighter. You don't learn how to be an MMA fighter in 6 months, like most wrestling programs will try to teach you. You know, and this is, for $100 a month, it's a great deal. And for tickets for my show on January 25th, $5. Bring four people, $10. I'm literally trying to pack the house so that we have an amazing crowd with an amazing show. We live stream on YouTube. The YouTube page is Sanctuary PA, or Sanctuary PA TV, I believe. And I cannot thank you enough for the rub and putting me on the show today.
No, you can't. You can't, but I'll keep giving you opportunities to, John, I assure you. All right, thank you, buddy. I appreciate your time.
Thanks. Yep, bye-bye.
All right, guys, that was John Trotsky. You know, that was very interesting. I didn't really mean to turn this into to a political anything, a soapbox or whatever, but I am curious. You know, different parts of the country are different. And there's some things that go on out here in Oregon that I don't see. And I'll hear about it and I'll deny it. I'll go, that's not true. Or we don't have that problem. Well, I'm ignorant to the fact because I'm lucky. I'm lucky that I haven't seen a lot of things. I often will resist racism when I hear something happened and it was due to race. I'll resist that. But the point is, I'm a little ignorant to it because I just didn't see it. I went to schools where we didn't see it. I was in diverse situations where I was the minority, but everybody treated me fine. I just haven't seen it. I want to know, you know, what the beat is from a local guy in New York. And I hope you guys are listening. I hope you're listening to what I said to him. I don't think that these cop situations need to keep coming down to, do you try a guy or do you not? I think there's more room than that. There's somewhere in the middle. And at the very least, that was a wimpy, cowardly move. There was five guys. And once again, I can't relate. I've been in combat my whole life. There's nobody that weighs 360 pounds anywhere in the world that I couldn't take down in 2 seconds. So I don't necessarily relate. I don't feel those same fears and apprehensions. I don't have the same training as the cops, and I need to be cognizant of that. But at the same time, there was five of them, there was one of him, and that's a bunch of crap. You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to Your Welcome with Chael Sonnen. Download new episodes every week at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.